The Capital Investment Committee for January 25th is called to order. Members, I just want to welcome our new permanent CLA, Abdulaziz. He'll be with us, and so if you have any questions, requests, or anything, you know, feel free to reach out to him and welcome him to the committee. Vice Chair Ryder, may I have a motion to approve the minutes for January 18th? I do want to note that we do have a quorum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the minutes for the 15th.
Members, any discussion for the minutes for January 18th? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion to approve bills and the minutes for January 18th is approved. Vice Chair Ryder, can I have a motion to approve the minutes for January 23rd?
Mr. Chair, I move the minutes be approved for January 23rd.
So before we move on for the minutes for the 23rd, I do want to note a correction for the meeting at the top right. Right now it's indicating first meeting. We'll just have staff correct that to be the fifth meeting. And so any discussion on the minutes for January 23rd? Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the minutes for the 23rd is approved. Members, today we are taking up Chair Howard's bill, House File 302, which we had an informational meeting on Monday and a presentation from some of his testifiers, so it will just be Chair Howard today. I'll move House File 302 to be recommended to be referred to the Housing Finance and Policy Committee. Welcome, Chair Howard. And then there's also the A1 amendment that I mentioned on Monday. Members, the A1 amendment will delete the GO portion of the proposal before us so that we will carry the GO portion if we do have a bonding bill, as Chair Howard moved his housing infrastructure bond proposal forward. Any discussion on the A1 amendment? Hearing none, those in favor of the A1 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. Chair Howard.
Chair Lee, thank you, and thanks again for the joint hearing we had earlier this week. It was really wonderful to kind of get both of our committees together, get outside of our silos, and do good work. As a reminder, this is the bill that we heard testimony on that would utilize housing infrastructure bonds to build the housing that we need all across the state, and appreciated that conversation and the chance to be back again and move this along to the next committee.
Thank you, Chair Howard. Member, any discussions to House File 302? Representative Myers.
Thank you, Chair Lee. Representative Hansen, I just had a question on the dollar amount of the $750 million. I wasn't here for the last meeting. Just wondering how that number came about, or you know, who helped work that number.
Chair Howard.
Thank you, Chair Lee and Representative Myers. The figure comes from what we believe is the need, and one piece of it is that we've established that $375 million would be spent in the first year and then $375 the next year to kind of create that dependable pipeline. On the impact, this would allow for the creation of upwards of 4,000 or more units of housing, and that'd be both multifamily and multifamily and single-family homes. And so the number was arrived based on kind of our experience with the need out there and a number that we believe these dollars would be spent and spent on shovel-ready projects across the state.
Representative Myers.
Thank you for that. You know, this is exciting because we're actually hearing something that is going to help with the housing crisis. And actually, you know, brick and mortar is very important. Just to expand off that a little bit, do you have an idea of how much maybe this will impact northern, southern Minnesota versus, you know, the Twin Cities area of the, you know, $375 million?
Chair Howard.
Chair Lee, Representative Myers, I don't have handy statistics about existing housing infrastructure bonds, but Minnesota Housing could get those to you. But what I would say, generally speaking, it's kind of an RFP process that Minnesota Housing operates, and in the past those funds have been utilized fairly equitably. And at a resource at this level, which I think is needed, you'd see basically, I think, historic levels of investment in every region of the state.
Representative Myers.
Thank you.
Members, any further discussion? All right, seeing no further discussion, I renew my motion that House File 302 as amended be re-referred to the Housing Finance and Policy Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails, and Chair Howard, you're on your way. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members.
So next on the agenda, members, we have today with us Director Freeman from the Public Facilities Authority to come and talk about the intended use plan for the Clean Water and Drinking Water Fund. And also we have Mr. Kolstad from the Department of Health to talk about lead service lines. And so Director Freeman, I believe you're first, so please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, members. I think the screens are working. Okay, good. My name is Jeff Freeman. I'm the Executive Director of the Public Facilities Authority. We are the agency that provides financing.
Mr. Freeman, can you speak a little bit closer to the microphone, please?
Financing to cities for water infrastructure projects. So the PFA finances all types of municipal wastewater and drinking water infrastructure, replacing aging pipes, various kinds of system improvements, treatment plant upgrades, as well as extensions to serve existing needs. Municipal wastewater and drinking water systems are owned, operated, and maintained by the cities and other local governments. They operate these water systems as enterprise funds, which have user charges that are charged proportionate to each user's use of the system. It provides a very stable source of revenue to operate and maintain these systems. The state financing programs start with the Clean Water and Drinking Water State Revolving Funds. These are our largest programs. They are low-interest loan programs. Since the start in 1990, we've made $4.4 billion in loans to cities throughout the state. The loan programs are supported by annual federal and state match funds, with all of the loan repayments revolving back to make new loans. Because the cities have their user charges as a stable source of revenue, these revolving funds are a very effective tool to provide financial assistance for these projects. The state and federal funds provide equity in the fund to subsidize the loan interest rates, providing significant interest savings to the cities and their residents, and an ongoing benefit to cities throughout the state, and these funds are managed in perpetuity. So these are resources available to Minnesota municipalities in perpetuity. To date, each $1 of state funds have generated $15 in construction. So it's a very cost-effective way for the state to provide assistance to cities to build these water infrastructure projects. A portion of the federal funds are also used as principal forgiveness grants for disadvantaged communities and green infrastructure projects. In addition to the loans, many cities are not able to fund their projects with loan funds alone. Most of the projects we fund are loan-only projects, but smaller cities especially don't have the user base to support the kinds of capital improvements to replace aging infrastructure and make the improvements that they need. The state WIF program was established to provide grants for priority projects that would otherwise be unaffordable. Affordability is determined based on per household system costs for operation and maintenance, existing debt service, new project costs compared to the median income of the service area. WIF grants are packaged with PFA loans, or we also are used to co-fund projects with our federal partners, USDA Rural Development, that also runs loan and grant programs for water infrastructure. Finally, there's the Point Source Implementation Grant Program, which specifically provides grant funding to help cities make treatment plant upgrades for water quality improvements. So when there are impaired waters or other water quality issues that require more stringent discharge requirements by the Pollution Control Agency, the PSIG program provides grants up to $7 million to help cities make those improvements. A lot of this is for phosphorus treatment, reducing the discharge of phosphorus. In other cases, chlorides, mercury, there's been some projects. So it's specifically targeted at those pollutants that are creating water quality concerns. The PFA funding framework starts with all projects being ranked on the project priority list that are maintained by the Pollution Control Agency for the clean water state funding projects. And clean water in this and the federal lexicon is wastewater projects as well as stormwater. And then the drinking water projects, drinking water treatment plants, water towers, wells, all of that, those are ranked by the health department on the drinking water priority list. SRF loans are available to all projects in fundable range. Last year, we made about $211 million in loans at an average interest rate less than 2%. And then there are the targeted grants based on affordability, as I talked about, and the treatment plant upgrades. In total, we made 26 grants last year, $57 million. Our goal with these programs is to have a stable and predictable funding process so that cities can plan their projects. These are projects that can take years of planning and design and preparation for construction. Cities need to have some confidence that funding will be available for them when they complete that work and we fund a project when it's ready to go to construction. We operate these programs, as I mentioned, in partnership with the Pollution Control Agency and the Health Department. Each of those agencies prepares their project priority lists, which are really a five-year project pipeline of cities that are preparing projects and plan to seek funding when those are ready for construction. The projects are ranked based on age and condition of the existing infrastructure, as well as public health and water quality criteria. The Pollution Control Agency and Health Department also do the technical reviews, the engineering reviews, plans and specifications, as well as the environmental reviews that are required for these projects. My agency, the PFA, prepares an annual intended use plan, which sets the fundable range for projects that are seeking funding each year. We have more demand than we have capacity, so there's the priority list comes into play in terms of how many projects and how far down the list can we offer funding to each year. We do the financial and credit review of all the applicants, making sure that cities have appropriate user charges to meet their operation and maintenance costs, their existing debt service, as well as the new project cost. We award the financing, disperse funds as costs are incurred, and do the ongoing monitoring and collecting loan repayments. So I kind of talked about this. Cities get on the priority list when they start to plan their projects, and when they're ready for construction, they request to be placed on that intended use plan. The annual IUPs are generally approved in October of each year. Funds are not awarded until projects are bid and ready to start construction. Projects that receive technical approval and certification by Pollution Control or Health Department at the end of each fiscal year are automatically carried over to the fundable range for the intended use plan the next year. Projects that don't get that technical approval can just simply reapply to the project or to the intended use plan for the next year. The federal infrastructure funds through the IIJA will provide significant additional funding for these programs. Approximately $668 million over 5 years. The funding is divided between about half of it will go for supplemental funds to those existing clean water and drinking water state revolving funds that I mentioned. Half of that money will be used for principal forgiveness grants for the disadvantaged communities and green infrastructure projects. The balance is then used for loans, and there are some small set-asides for administration and technical assistance. Those supplemental funds do require a state match. The match requirement is 10% for the first 2 years and increases to 20% for the next three. Then in addition, the IIJA appropriates dedicated funding for two new project categories, replacement of drinking water lead service lines and emerging contaminants. For lead service lines, 49% of the funds are available as principal forgiveness grants, which essentially are grants. Federal term is principal forgiveness, which is awkward and nobody understands what that means, but it's essentially a grant. 16% is for can be used for set-asides, including lead service line inventories. Chad will talk more about that in a few minutes. And that leaves about 35% then available for loans on the lead service line replacement. Emerging contaminant funding is 100% principal forgiveness with no state match. No state match either on the lead service line projects. This table shows a breakdown of or comparison of the regular federal capitalization grants that we typically receive for the revolving loan funds. These are the numbers from 2022 compared to the first year of the IIJA funds. As you can see, the total with IIJA is about three times or more than three times what we would otherwise expect. And then it does have those additional categories, existing programs, lead service line replacement, $43 million a year, 43.2, and drinking water contaminants, emerging contaminants at 11.5. So for this legislative session, we are hoping to receive state match funds and as well as funding for the WIF grants and the affordability or the PSIG grants. The state match are calculated based on the needs through 2024. The governor will be announcing his bonding recommendations, I believe, tomorrow with the details on that. We're also looking for some changes to policy language, PFA statutes, in order to more fully utilize those funds for lead service lines and emerging contaminants. In particular, on the lead service lines, we are the language changes will allow us to provide 100% grant funding for the privately owned portion. Chad is going to explain more about this, but the service line on a that goes from the city's water main and the street to each house typically is owned part by the city, part by the private homeowner. And the private portion, our plan is to fund that at 100% grant, so there's no cost back to the property owner. And then the public portion, these changes would allow us to make those loans at 0% to the cities for the publicly owned portion. I've got more detailed project lists and things that we'll talk about later, but I'll stop there for now and ask if there's any questions.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Freeman. This is probably a good point before you get more into the federal money I think you were talking about. I'm curious if the chair will allow. Legacy, you get about $16 million, which is totally different clean money, clean water fund money. But what are you doing that's different? And do you need the clean water legacy money since you have so much federal money? Or do we, you know, so I'm a little confused. I should know by now after all these years, but it just, you know, the legacy money is supposed to be towards new stuff, and I don't know that it is.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lilly, so the legacy funds go primarily to that point source implementation grant program to make those specific water quality improvements, reducing pollutant discharges to address impaired waters and other water quality improvements. That program started out funded through the legacy funds from the beginning. In 2016, 2017, Governor Dayton at that time recommended that there be additional bonding appropriations to supplement what was coming from the legacy, because the needs were great, and the idea was another source of funds to help supplement those funds. So that's where those funds primarily go, to that point source implementation grant program. There's a small amount of legacy funds that go to a program, I didn't mention it here, called the Small Community Wastewater Treatment Program, that is specifically focused on very small, unsewered communities, providing technical assistance to help them look at treatment alternatives when essentially the existing septic systems are non-compliant, the lots are too small to build a compliant system, the community is trying to figure out what they can do. There's technical assistance funds to help with that, as well as some construction funds to help build community cluster drain fields and that kind of thing.
Chair Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've always, felt you're doing a good job, and just still, I think people have always been on this committee have just really appreciated it. But, I appreciate your explaining a little deeper on what the differences are. Thank you.
Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Chair Lee. I'm sorry I missed the beginning. Director Freeman, as former mayor of Ely, Minnesota, and a recipient of PSIC and PFA, everyone's shaking their head. Our clerk treasurer does a great job in filling everything out, and knowing how this works and what it did for our community and what it did for our ratepayers, it's a fair and balanced system. The ratepayers, if you're paying low, you're going to have to raise your rates in order to qualify for this. I think it's a great program. It helped us immensely, and I know it helps that people in my district and 3A and all of northern Minnesota. But I just wanted to thank you, and that I understand what you do, and I want to support you as much as I can. Thank you. So, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Director Freeman, I'm looking on the PFA funding framework page, and the PFA funding follows a stable and predictable process so cities can plan and prepare for their projects. And if when you're using median household income, that people who qualify under that criteria can plan. But it's my understanding with the lead service lines that you can use other affordability criteria, that my census tract, that there are other things that you can, that you have adopted with lead service lines. Is that right, or am I confused by that?
Director Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, we, with the lead service lines, pose some unique issues in terms of the fact that if it wasn't for these funds, the only way for that privately owned portion of the service line to be funded would be a special assessment back to the property owner, which obviously would be a serious obstacle to the goal of getting all of these lines replaced. So We have looked at the existing WIF affordability criteria, and essentially it's the same approach, but dealt with a little differently and by looking at what's the regular water user rate that a household in whatever city it is pays, and then in addition that assessment that gets added on top, and we do for other projects as well, when costs are assessed to a smaller group of homeowners for a particular project, in this case to a specific homeowner, we do factor that into the overall cost, and we believe right now for the projects that have applied to date, just using the community-wide median household income and looking at both the regular rates as well as the assessment or the cost to the household, it does exceed the 1.2% threshold on all of the projects we've looked at so far. As this goes along, when we get to a case where it doesn't reach that 1.2 based on the overall city median income, we certainly would work with the cities to and well, we encourage them to take into account, you know, looking at health equity and other issues for where they're planning these projects. And we certainly would look at census tract income of the particular project area as a way to make sure that we can use those principal forgiveness funds for meeting those needs. So that's our goal. We think that's a good plan. We're looking forward to getting the first year of the IIJ fund started this year with that approach.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a follow-up on that and maybe building off some questions in the previous day we had testimony. So let's say you've got a city that has a couple manufactured home parks that are their sewer hookup is their and those census tracts that they're in have a very high poverty rate. But there may be very wealthy people, wealthy homes in the community as well. And so with medium household income, and that's applied across, then how do you reach the requirement under the IIJA of making sure that we're providing justice, and how do we make sure we're providing support for those who have the least ability to pay for it? Because you may have census tracts that we know the poverty rate, we know that they may not have the ability to pay, but other people can pay very well, so you look at the overall city and say, well, they don't qualify.
Director Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, PFA statutes and rules do allow for looking at census tract income or even in some cases an income survey to if the citywide median income is believed to be not reflective of that particular project service area, there are provisions in the statute to look at the income level of that smaller area, and that's how we would handle that.
Representative Hansen.
Just finally, so, you know, I think this is really critical as we have tons of money coming in. And, you know, do we help the least of us first who don't have either the ability to pay or they may be impacted by water contamination? And I look, you know, and looked in the past where money goes. And there may be places that are being missed because they're in part of a large community. Maybe not even that large. Maybe it's a wealthy community, but there are pockets of poverty. How do we? I think we've got to do better on that and reaching those communities within the communities to make sure that they get help.
Members, any additional? Representative Squaba.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Lee. I have one follow-up question. Director Freeman, you spoke about the lead line. The private is from the house to, we'll call it the corporation. Where I come from, the individual owns all the way up to the main. So how do you deal with that? Or do you just say, you can't own up to the main, we're not going to pay the whole thing? Or is it what each community? Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Director Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Graba, we do recognize that not every city is structured the same in terms of that ownership. And it goes back to city ordinances that were put in place when those water systems were originally installed 100 years, more than 100 years ago, probably. So, yes, there are the majority of cities that we've seen, it's a split ownership, public, private, but there are definitely a number of cities where it is public or privately owned all the way from the house to the street. So in those cases, again, our goal is to cover 100% of the private costs with the principal forgiveness grant fund. So we would continue to do that. So the funding mix would be different there, but that would still be our approach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Freeman, I have a question about the green infrastructure provisions on one of the early pages, the PFA Water Infrastructure Program page, where it says a portion of federal funds are provided as principal forgiveness grants for disadvantaged communities and green infrastructure. Can you specify a little more what a portion means? I have some follow-ups about that.
Director Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ryer, the green infrastructure, it's defined under federal law for the state revolving fund, and then state law, state statutes pick up on that as well. And it essentially is, it covers both projects that are focused on energy efficiency, reducing energy consumption, renewable energy at a treatment plant, making use of renewable energy sources, as well as stormwater treatment and various kinds of resiliency when there needs to be a water quality benefit to the project, but there are resiliency projects where stormwater becomes an issue and we can fund some projects with stormwater as green infrastructure. And so it's kind of a broad category, and I think we probably need to do better at communicating to cities what's possible, what are the opportunities under those funds, especially now with the much larger principal forgiveness component of the IIJA funds. Right now, the green infrastructure projects can receive 25% grant funding up to $1 million. I think all of that perhaps is something that we'll want to look at more closely and certainly work with cities to promote those kinds of projects. We funded a number of energy improvements, and there are some where the stormwater, a project in Minneapolis that I recall, there's been a project in Afton, a few stormwater projects, but I think we can do better at getting the word out on that.
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Freeman. When it says a portion of federal funds, does the federal funding come with requirements of a certain share of the funds to be used for these categories?
Director Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes. The IIJA funds have a specific mandate of 49% of the funds for principal forgiveness. The regular federal funds typically have a range that states can use, and it's sometimes it varies from one year to the next sometimes in terms of the appropriation language by Congress. But we have used those funds somewhat judiciously. They meet the same, for disadvantaged communities, they work the same as the WIF grants. And so when projects get certified and are ready to go to construction, we've got both state WIF funds, and then as needed, we can tap into those federal principal forgiveness grants to accomplish the same purpose to make those projects affordable. We also have used those for the green infrastructure projects that have come forward and through the process. We've funded all of those with that 25% up to $1 million. We have funded all of the eligible projects that have been approved and come through the process with those funds.
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Director. So I'm looking for context on your goals related to green infrastructure as an agency within the scope of what you are enabled to do. Clearly, with the climate crisis that's facing us and the threats that we have, the need for more efficiency, the need for resiliency, and taking advantage of every opportunity, where would you say you're on the spectrum of within the federal guidelines and funding, we're doing everything we can versus we're doing some? I've heard you say we could be doing more. What does that look like, and what's your vision for what doing more looks like, and how will you get there?
Director Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it starts with, and I my partners at Pollution Control Agency that set those project priorities, determine eligible projects. All of the projects that come through for technical review are required to go through a cost and effectiveness criteria and approval that requires cities to look at energy efficiency, how they can use energy more efficiently, look at renewable energy opportunities, as well as, all the projects are required to look at those things. As far as the stormwater related and kind of resiliency, there are other, PCA has initiatives, and I believe in the governor's budget for to improve water infrastructure resiliency, and it ties in with the stormwater that we're looking at when there is a water quality component, as I mentioned. So it's a little complicated, but we have been talking with our partners at Pollution Control Agency that I think we need to do a better job of sort of integrating the programs that they have. There's other funding sources that are available, and the State Revolving Fund has, as I mentioned, these opportunities as well. I don't think we have that integrated as well as we should and could. So that's what I meant by doing a better job with that.
Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair Lee, and to our testifiers. My question is around bouncing off on the funds. Are there dollars set aside to really do the work of community engagement, especially with communities who have been historically excluded, for example, with green infrastructure? You know, there are lots of co-benefits that can come with building out green infrastructure that helps with public safety, with connecting communities, climate mitigation. So I'll bounce that back to you of if there are dollars specifically that communities, cities, municipalities can work with to co-design and co-create that green infrastructure.
Director Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, all of the planning and design related costs that are lead toward a project are reimbursable once the project is ready for funding. So, and yes, we certainly would, and we We work with cities all the time and encourage them to, look at those opportunities, and this is what I mentioned, we need to do more, but we would be able to reimburse for those essentially planning, pre-project planning, pre-design kinds of costs. We can do reimbursement once the project's ready for construction.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Freeman. Sorry if I ask questions, but I've been following another little bill right now. There's a civics thing up in the Senate that I had to pay a little attention to. And it's probably on here somewhere, but what was the appropriation in the last bonding bill for PFA?
Director Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, the last bonding bill was 2020, so stretches my memory a little bit on the, I think the program funds were a little over, right around 100 million, and then there were some special appropriation earmarks on top of that. I don't remember the exact total.
Mr. Lee, are you able to provide us with that number?
Okay.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Ms. Chairman. I think that's pretty close to what we're doing. Obviously, the more money that's put into PFA, the farther down the list you can go. Is that a correct assumption?
Director Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl. Yes, what we do is we set that fundable cutoff line, and with the additional funds, we want to push that down in a way that at a stable level. We don't want that cutoff to bounce around up and down each year. So, but certainly more funds allow us to fund more projects, absolutely.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Freeman. So I'm looking at this list. It's the Part A for fundable carryover projects. Is that the current? Is this the fundable range on at the present time?
Director Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, so yes, and I hadn't actually gotten into the list yet, but what you're looking at is there's the one that says CWRF, Clean Water Revolving Fund, and then there's the Drinking Water Revolving Fund. The first page and a half or so of both of those are the carryover projects that I mentioned that are automatically, once they get technical approval in a prior fiscal year, they're automatically carried over to the fundable range. And then there are new project requests that typically we would set, the IUP would set the fundable range for those new project requests. In this case, for this year's intended use plans, you'll see a heading that says Part B new project requests not fundable at this time. And what that means is these are the new projects that have requested to be receive funding to go ahead with their projects for 2023. But because we didn't get the state match last year, we also can't get the federal funds. So they're sort of on hold while we get the additional funding so we can set a fundable range for those new projects.
Representative Erdahl, you're jumping ahead of us, and so that will be the next portion of the agenda.
I've tried to do that a lot.
Mr. Lee, can you provide us with the information that Representative Erdahl was asking about the 2020 appropriations?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Erdahl. In the 2020 capital investment article, the total for Public Facilities Authority was $269 million. Of that, $25 million was state match for federal grants for the revolving loan programs. $33.2 million was the clean water infrastructure. $22 million was drinking water infrastructure. $44.5 million was point source implementation. And $144 million were individual named projects.
Thank you.
So, Director Freeman, before we move on, I just have a quick question for you regarding the page that you have the 2022 federal funds, and you have a note saying that our federal cap grants was reduced by $14 million because of congressional earmark. And so was that taken out of the portion that was coming to Minnesota or the feds outside of their larger programs take out that $14 million, if that makes sense? Dr. Freeman.
Yes, Mr. Chair. So the Congress hadn't done earmarks for quite a while. You're probably aware last year they started doing earmarks for water infrastructure again, and the way they did it was there was the amount set for the state revolving fund appropriations. They subtracted the total earmarks across the country, and then the balance was divided based on the formula that's used. So in Minnesota's case, $14 million, roughly less. So that does reduce our state match need. We have communicated that with MMB and the governor's office, and the governor's recs, I think, will make that adjustment.
So if I'm understanding this right, then if we're just to do the math, Minnesota would have expected to get around $45 million, but because of the earmarks, that's why we're at 31.
Correct. But,
okay. Representative Kozlowski, last question here, and then we'll move on to the next part of the agenda.
Thank you, Chair, and to our testifiers. Quick question, can you remind us what is the state's goal for replacing lead service lines?
Director Freeman.
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Could you remind us when the state has a goal of and replacing all of the lead service lines? Like, is there a year target?
Director Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, at this point, there's not a specific established goal. Representative Jordan has a bill for some state funds that would set a goal of 10 years, and I think that's kind of what people have been focused on. That's in a proposed bill.
Thank you so much. That's great. Thinking about, you know, the generation of children currently drinking out of those lines, so thank you for that.
So, Director Freeman, you may proceed with discussing the IUPs, and then Mr. Kolstad to talk about the lead service line, and hopefully you can answer some of the questions that were brought forth around that piece specifically. So please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in your packets, there are a bunch of spreadsheets. The first one I'll refer to is the clean CWRF, the intended use plan project list, and as I mentioned earlier, this is the intersection of project readiness to proceed with the priority list that the Pollution Control Agency maintains. So you can see priority rankings and points listed there, but projects are in those carryover categories approved in prior years. There's various reasons why a project may have technical approval, but isn't actually ready to go to construction or isn't ready for funding for sometimes a few years. And so that's what you're looking at with those carryover projects. The second page starts with that Part B, not fundable at this time, new project requests. And you can see the columns with the not only the estimated loan amount and project cost, but as well also the estimated amounts for the various other grant programs that are combined with these funds. If you flip to the green sheets, this is the entire five-year project priority list from the Pollution Control Agency that we have then overlaid the estimated funding from the various sources, various programs, and also our partners, USDA Rural Development and others. This list goes back to the start of FY23 last July, so we have been funding carryover projects as they're ready to go, and the projects you see with the gray rows all the way across have now been funded. Those are under construction. Finally, at the back, there's some yellow sheets that list the PPL projects in priority order. If you're looking for a particular project on the list, that alphabetical order may help. In total, these clean water projects on the current priority list, there's 276 projects for about $2.4 billion. Again, keep in mind this is a five-year list, so some of these are ready for construction now or actually under, as I said, the gray rows, and some are just starting the planning process. So this is a list of all of those projects in various stages. Also then in your packet is the sheets that say DWRF, and it's the same approach. The first page and a half or so are the carryover projects that have already been approved technically and are waiting for funding. There also are shown the starting at the bottom of the first page onto the second page, the lead service line projects, the first year requests that we've received for lead service line replacement. And you can see those projects. We have used this list now to apply for the federal funds, and but we do need those policy changes that I mentioned to really be able to fully utilize these funds. But we're hopeful these projects can go to construction this summer. There is a category for emerging contaminant projects. That's the other dedicated funding category of the IIJA federal funds. You'll see that these, in this case, right now, the first year are focused on manganese treatment. Chad will be able to explain more about that, but there will be, in subsequent years, we know that PFAS is obviously an important concern, and we will be seeing more projects for PFAS treatment ranked on this list. Unfortunately, the federal funds for PFAS, about $17 million a year, aren't going to go very far compared to the cost of some of those larger PFAS treatments. So the policy changes that we've established provide some fairly tight limits to those grants, trying to spread the money out as much as we can. Finally, I just want to take a minute to talk about what is titled at the top, Estimated Funding Needs Report Table 4. And it says draft on the top right corner. This is a table from a report that we're required to submit to the legislature by February 1st. We're putting the finishing touches on that report. But this table, as directed by statute, shows the for wastewater projects that are eligible or trigger the WIF grants or the point source implementation grants, it shows the cost per household of those projects, either with the grants, with those PFA grants, and without the PFA grants. And it compares that to the Metropolitan Council Environmental Services does a survey of metro area wastewater charges, which you can see at the top right there. Their 2022 survey identified an average cost of $377 per year. So that's a little over $30 a month for wastewater service in the metro area. And then you can see that number compared with other cities on this list. As I mentioned, typically the WIF grants that are based on affordability go to the smaller communities because the size, and you can see the household equivalent size numbers on all of these projects. They just don't have the user base to spread those costs out, so the costs are typically higher in those small communities. The PSIG grants, I should mention, are not based on affordability. That's strictly based on meeting those water quality treatment plant upgrade requirements. So that's not an affordability-based grant program. So I will stop there, but wanted to show you this as kind of an illustration. Of course, the numbers are all over. As you look at these cities, they have different dollar amounts, different cost figures per year, per household. And there can be all sorts of reasons why cities have those different numbers based on obviously the number of users, but also the discharge requirements that they're required to meet on their wastewater plant, the age and condition of their existing infrastructure, to the extent to which a city has done previous project phases and is now paying existing debt services, which is one of the columns there for fixed costs. The PFA funds, of course, can only help with the new project costs. The fixed costs for O&M and existing debt service are locked in. I'll stop there. I just wanted to call your attention to that, the differences between various cities, metro and non-metro, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Branson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just kind of wondering, is the inflation factored into this?
Director Freeman.
For the projects that you know you're waiting for to start, is the inflation part of this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Franson, so when cities are working with their consultants on doing their cost estimates, and when they do updates to those cost estimates based on inflation or other factors, we, as soon as we get those new estimates, we build those into this list.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you know, I think we've gone over this before, but for comparison, the Twin Cities metropolitan area weighted average annual retail does not take into account extreme differences among communities in the metropolitan area. So when you look at cities here and you put their cost and then you have for comparison a weighted an average across the whole metro area of $377, it provides a bias in the impression. Because it makes it look like all these communities that are getting grants are paying more than the metro area. I don't know how many times we have to say the metropolitan area is made up of multiple communities with multiple differences in charges and what their residents pay. It is not a monolith. It is not a monolith for comparison.
Director Freeman, I have a question. Just going back to the IUP and the emerging contaminants. And you said that with the funding that we have, roughly $17 million per year coming for the next 5 years will not be enough. Do we or the MPCA or you understand what is like the extent of the issue for us in the state with regards to PFAS?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to defer that question to my partners at the health department, although I'm guessing the answer is no, there's not a fully developed estimate across the state.
Mr. Kostad, why don't you proceed with your presentation and then you can answer my question throughout your presentation or at the end after your presentation.
Chairly, committee members, my name is Chad Kolstad. I am the Drinking Water Protection Unit Supervisor for the Infrastructure Program at Department of Health. Today I'm just going to provide you a little information to give you some more details about lead service lines in Minnesota. So to start with, just so everyone knows, the source of lead in drinking water isn't typically our source waters in Minnesota. It's not the wells, it's not the lakes, it's not the rivers, it's actually the piping and the service lines that feed the homes. You also can find lead that leaches into the water from lead solder and lead fixtures, but the lead service lines are the most common. Many systems have done a great job across Minnesota over the years with corrosion control, so they feed chemicals that prevents the lead from leaching in the water, so we've done a very good job preventing large lead exceedances throughout the state. But we all know there is no safe level of lead. This next little diagram is just to provide you a little bit more detail about what a lead service line actually is for those of you that aren't as familiar with it. So as you know, there's a water main out in the street. That's where the water comes from the treatment plant out to the homes in the street. Once you actually tie off that water main to feed water to the house, it goes through, and I wanted to point out that you can kind of see the gooseneck, that little jump up on the diagram. That's called the gooseneck. And then it turns into the service line, which goes to the curb stop, which is just a valve, basically usually at the property line. And then from that curb stop, it goes back to service line material again, and then into the house to the meter. So those are just kind of the components of a lead service line. So just keep those in mind. The challenges with lead service lines are, first off, we have 1.4 million service lines across the state of Minnesota. We're anticipating that there's at least 100,000 of those service lines that are lead. The big challenge that Jeff alluded to earlier is that the ownership varies depending upon the system. We had Minnesota Rural Water Association do a survey for us a few years ago, and about 70% of the water systems in Minnesota have split ownership. And when I say split ownership, basically what that means is, if you look back on that previous diagram, the utility owns from that water main to that curb stop or that valve in the street, and then the homeowner owns the remaining balance of that line. But there's also a large majority, about 30% of the remaining systems, that don't own any of the service line, as you kind of heard about Ely. That's pretty common. You know, Minneapolis, some of the larger cities do not have any ownership of that service line. So it makes it a challenge to figure out the best way to fund these projects. The other problem with not having any ownership in those lines in a lot of cases is that the cities don't have good records because they don't own the service line. So that's part of a challenge that's going to be kind of need to be addressed in the future. The other challenge with these systems in Minnesota, as you know, we have a lot of very small systems in Minnesota. EPA defines a small system as a system under 3,300 in population. We have 800 of those. A very small system, we have 500 systems that are serving less than 500 people. So those are the small systems that, you know, you got a water operator that runs the water plant, the wastewater plant, maybe plows the streets, mows lawns. It's a one-person show. So to add additional resources to try and figure out how they're going to, they just don't have the additional resources in those small towns to do some of the work they need to figure out what kind of lead service lines they have in the ground. On top of that, there's the new regulations. Those new regulations came out in October of 2022, are basically the revisions to the lead and copper rule, the lead and copper rule revisions. For this presentation, the big takeaway there is that all systems, because we don't know how many lead service lines are out there, are required to complete a lead service inventory of their lines by October 16th of 2024. When they're doing those inventories, what you're really looking for is material type that's going into the homes. And there's basically, EPA has four categories that they can fall into. First, of course, is lead. The second one here is galvanized requiring replacement. And if you remember when I said pointed out that little loop in the service line going to the home, galvanized pipe is a very rigid pipe, so there has to be some ability for it to flex, especially when you bury it or whatever. So they put that little loop in, provide a little buffer for that service line to move and shift if need be. That typically at that time was made of lead. So you have a small piece of lead up front, a galvanized pipe, which typically will leach, and then you'll get buildup on those galvanized pipes. So that's a core category that's going to be required to be replaced as well. Of course, there's non-lead, so that's the newer construction that uses, you know, copper, polyethylene, plastic. And then the biggest challenge is going to be the unknowns, where the systems don't know what kind of material type they have. And in a lot of cases, they don't know unless they can go inside the home and figure out what material type is there. For that October 16th, 2024 deadline, systems can say that they have unknown services in their system, but there's consequences associated with that. They're required to notify the residents not only if they have a lead line or a galvanized line, but as well as an unknown line to make them aware that they may have a lead service line in their home. If they trigger a lead exceedance, so they have a concentration of lead that comes back high in their drinking water, they're required to do a replacement program. Currently, if they exceed a certain trigger, they have to replace 2% of their service lines that are lead, galvanized, and unknown. So it's their advantage to figure out what those unknown lines are, because that comes into that 3%. So based on some of the new regulations coming out, meeting with cities to figure out what their needs are, these are some of the opportunities and technical assistance we're providing for communities across Minnesota. So we're trying to do training exercises to water system staff. We have a contract with the Minnesota Rural Water Association we currently have a person hired to do in-person and virtual trainings for all the water operators across the state. He does the trainings once a month, basically. I'm speaking at one tomorrow in Detroit Lakes. The second one item here is direct technical assistance for completing inventories. And this is the biggest challenge, right? For these small systems, they don't have the resources, as I discussed earlier, to complete these lead service line inventories on their own. So we're trying to put together a program that's going to basically hire consulting engineers that are familiar with the funding programs to assist these communities with actually conducting their lead service line inventories. Those inventory categories that the cities can apply for assistance and would be broken into three categories. The first would be record review. So this would actually be going into their systems files, looking through the files, and the general idea there is to eliminate the number of service lines that you actually physically have to put your eyes on to make a determination of what the material type they are. So that's category one. The second category would be visual inspection, and that's where you physically would have to go into the house and see that line, figure out what material type it is, and document it. And finally, once we get the records review done, then visual inspection done, they can actually complete the inventory. And once the inventory is complete, they'll be required to put together a replacement plan. And this is where the health equity criteria kind of comes into play a little bit, is as part of those replacement plans, they not only have to look at efficient use of the funds, but at also health equity criteria that they feel is fitting for their particular community. So MDH is currently working on providing that guidance to look at, you know, different health equity criteria, be it from the environmental justice tool at EPA. A neat thing we kind of came across that was developed during COVID with some COVID funds was they have a lead level tracking tool at the census level that shows where higher elevated levels of lead are for children throughout the state at the census block. So we'll overlay some of that data. But these will be developed by the consultants for these towns to help them figure out what their priorities should be for their system. Currently, we're planning to fund this assistance program with the IIJA funds. We can use 10% of that $43 million to fund this program, so that's what we're going to do each year for the next 5 years. I know the inventory program, the inventories had to be submitted by October of next year, but like I said, there's going to be a lot of inventories that are going to be submitted without unknowns, and those unknowns are going to have to be cleaned up and clarified over the years, and that's going to take some time. And then finally, as we get these inventories in, we have a contract with the University of Minnesota to develop a statewide lead service line inventory map. What that map is going to allow is going to allow residents to go into this application, type in their address, figure out if they have a lead service line, and provide guidance and communication to those residents, as well as potentially a contact number with the community that they're in to let them know that they want their lead service line replaced. So hopefully this all builds up and helps us figure out the best way to put our resources towards lead service line replacement. And with that, I'll take any questions.
Mr. Kosak, can you speak to the piece around the emerging contaminants that I asked about? Especially with what you have on the IUP here is mostly on manganese. And so just trying to figure out, are we expecting PFAS to show up? And are you aware of any communities that are planning to seek funding because of PFAS?
Charlie, yes, I can definitely talk a little bit about emerging contaminants and kind of PFAS in general. For this first year, we had a lot of systems that were applying for manganese. So we were kind of maybe a little bit ahead of with our manganese standards. What it comes down to at MDH is we look at if they have received a health risk advisory notice, and some of you in your district may have seen those. I can get you more details about that if you want. But that notice basically is an awareness that when they apply for the project priority list, that they will be eligible for emerging contaminant funding. We're also going through some changes right now, some rule changes to our priorities that will increase the priority for contaminants of emerging concern, both manganese and PFAS. So that'll help raise these projects to the top of those lists. So even if there's not enough emerging contaminant funding, Jeff will be able to pass some of the other funds available like WIF and those others to those projects. As far as PFAS, your question about how much need is there in the state, that's a really good question. I know we've worked with PCA to try and start putting some numbers together. You know, my manager from Drinking Water Protection is here. We can probably get you those like rough numbers at some point. But it's kind of more the projects that are willing to move forward. Some of them are still wrapping their heads around what this means. I believe the only project on the PPL for this year is the city of Fridley. They were proposing to do some PFAS treatment, but they did not apply for the IUP at this point because I think they still are trying to weigh their options.
Thank you. If you could provide that information to our community administrator, that'd be great.
Yeah.
Members, any questions on the IUP or lead service lines? Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair. My question has to do with the extent of lead service lines in Minnesota. I assume it's a dated situation, that is, that they stopped being used after a certain date. Is that, first of all, is that correct?
Mr. Colstadt.
Shirley, a representative. Yeah, we did a survey with Minnesota Water Association a few years ago and trying to figure out kind of when the last service lines were used in Minnesota. We kind of tied it to when their wells were drilled and when their system started up. And for the most part, the latest well service lines that we found were 53 and 58. Those were like kind of the oldest systems that had lead service lines. The actual end date of when lead could actually be used in Minnesota for service lines is in the 80s. But most systems prior to that did not stop using lead well before that time.
Representative Carroll.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any additional questions, members? Seeing none, thank you, Director Freeman, and thank you, Mr. Colstadt, for coming by to present on these important topics. Members, just as a reminder, we will continue to have this conversation, and starting on Monday, we will be having presentation on the governor's bonding budget proposal from MMB, and then right after that, we'll have individual agencies come in and discuss their requests for our entire committee. With no further business before us, the meeting is adjourned.